This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are as Five Fact Checks. And this is, I have no idea how many takes this is taking.
Five. Take five.
This doesn't seem to be a right time or right place to record this, but...
Every time we try to record, we have an interruption or something else happens, or we think we're in a good place and it gets really noisy and we can't. So now we are coming to you from our balcony, outside.
Woo!
With the dog.
So you may hear snuffling, snorting...
Yelling at the dog. And come heck or high water, we're finishing this one now, because it's
This is the only take it's going to get.
This is getting worse than the soda episode was.
Yeah.
So, this
if
is a
review.
We don't
nail it in this, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm done. It will be banished.
This is a review. This is a book review of Waiter Rant and the blog Waiter Rant by Steve DeBlanica, also known as The Waiter.
Yes, your microphone was just snuffled by a Boston Terrier.
So.
Okay, so I discovered the blog back in the day when blogging was pretty...
Was that newfangled Web 2.0
well, no,
thing?
It was just after that, when people actually had started blogging, putting things up, because mm-hmm. we had actually been checking out another blog called TJ's Place, which was all about this guy that worked at a strip club. He was
yes.
like a manager there or something.
And it was the exact same premise as Waiter Rant.
Mm.
Waiter Rant, we should probably establish that first, is a blog. The fellow went and he decided to blog anonymously about where he worked, changed the names of everything, and it was kind of like an undercover waiter thing.
Right.
And TJ's Place was the exact same thing. All the names were changed, location was changed, his name was changed. So he could talk about managing a strip club. He was kind of the general manager, pretty
yeah,
much.
Yeah, he had to take care of the talent, the mm-hmm. DJs, make sure that all repairs were done that needed to be done. The bouncers, the bartenders, the waitresses, everything. The whole shebang. So
Waiter Rant had a much happier ending than TJ's Place because Waiter Rant...
Became
ended
a book.
Up, yeah, he ended up getting a book deal out of it. Got another book due out of it, too, that's coming out sometime later this year, whereas the fellow who did TJ's Place just dropped off the face of the planet, which is very sad.
We wish him well. He was an excellent writer.
He was, I think, a better writer than DeBlanica is,
yeah.
really. The dude really knew what he was doing. So, the best part about having done so many takes on this is we've really thought about it a lot, and we've
mm-hmm.
identified why we feel the way we do about some parts of the book and why we had certain reactions. I got a chance to read the entire blog. Sheila's read parts of the blog. Blog started back in 2004. The Waiter has been waiting since around 2000 or so. He started out in the mental health industry and got laid off. And Sheila said many,
you can go
many
from
times.
One nut house to another, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because working in the food industry is already crazy as it is.
So I think the blog almost was his way of coping with it as well.
Yeah.
And it seemed when he talked in the book that
it was skewed in very hindsight.
Well, when he talked about it in the book, it was almost like nobody knew he was doing it, except there was one section of the book where one chick, he was talking to one chick, and she asked if he was going to put this in the blog.
Yeah.
Whereas in the blog, it was very apparent that everybody knew he was doing it, where he
worked. Like, his coworkers would actually put comments and stuff on it.
Did
so,
they?
Yeah.
Okay, I never saw those. But I know, like, his boss knew about it, because his boss was really PO'd the one day that he almost got outed by Russell Crowe.
Yeah. Which is kind of hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Since usually it's movie stars that are being outed by waitstaff.
Yeah.
Oh my god, look, it's somebody famous! Please go mob them while they're trying to eat in public with their friends!
Yes. So the book, we're not going to go through it chapter by chapter or section by section like we normally do. It was an easy read. I didn't consider it a very enjoyable book.
I thought it was interesting enough, having worked in the food industry. It was okay.
Well, you've worked both counter service because at DP Dough,
yeah.
and you've done back kitchen stuff as well.
Yeah.
So you've seen the flip side of what he talks about, and you've experienced some of what he talks about in a totally different fashion because you're working just at a counter.
Right.
I've done counter in fast food, and I've bartended.
Right.
But I've never worked in a kitchen in a restaurant. So I get the waiter feeling from it. I understand that dealing with the public. Plus, I have other customer service experience. So we both have enough background that we should be able to relate very easily to what he talks about.
Mm.
So what'd you think about it? We'll just do a broad overview.
I was pretty much okay with it, except when he decides to start throwing out how things should be, because he works in a very specific sect of the restaurant world, and let's face it, we're not necessarily going to tip 20% on, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example.
Getting takeout. You don't
yeah.
tip 20% when you get takeout. You walk up, you pick it up, you leave.
Right. And just to show you how skewed it really is, some of the tips that he was expecting on one bill would be how much Tracy and I would pay for a meal for
yes.
both of us. He's expecting like a $30 tip because the place where he's working, you know, it's a upscale place, plus there's a lot of alcohol and a lot of people drink. So
I would say 99% of the people who read this book or have read this book did come out in like 2007-ish, 2008-ish.
Yeah, so it's not new news at all.
This is something we've picked up that's been out for a while. We've both been kind of curious about it. We finally got around to it because it was on sale. And we said, hey, let's give it a shot. But 99% of the people who read that book will have no experience in going to that kind of restaurant, except for maybe a special occasion here and there.
Mm.
What the audience he's writing this for is not the audience that he waits on. Those people would never even probably condescend to pick up a book like this. They're busy doing other things to make themselves look better, you know.
Yeah. The restaurant where he was waiting at, even though that wasn't the owner's intention, was a place where people went to be seen.
It was a swanky place. It was a hot spot in the city. It's called The Bistro. The real name of it is up online if you look hard enough for it. I don't remember what the name of the real place is either. But all the names have changed.
But it does lead us to our second point, which is there's something that people intrinsically that go to that place have a huge request for that we will just never understand.
And this was a completely foreign thing to Sheila and I. We've heard of it before. I still don't think it's that big of a deal, but apparently it's a huge problem when you go to this kind of
like
an upscale restaurant.
Like enough to cause a big scene over.
And it's about where you've been seated. I still don't understand why it's a big deal, but people would come in and have hissy fits over where their seat is. God forbid they'd be seated next to the bathroom. Now, personally, Sheila and I say if you want to be seen or you want to see people while they're out at the restaurant, the bathroom, you think, would be the perfect place to be seated by. Because if you bring a woman to a restaurant, guaranteed, she is going to the restroom at least once in that visit.
For real. And depending on how many drinks you have, you're probably going at least once, right?
Exactly. So it makes no sense to be fussy about, well, I want a window seat or I want this. The only part I can wrap my brain around when it comes to the seating preference is inside or outside.
Right.
Would you like to sit on the patio if you have one, or would you like to sit inside?
Or would you prefer a table or a banquette? Or
exactly.
What's the other
a
name
booth?
For them? A booth.
So that was something that was not, I'm not going to say it's a big focal point of the book, but
there is
a
lot of headaches.
It isn't a
main focal point, but it's very
arrogant, self-entitled people coming in and demanding certain seats because they know the owner or something like that, which we do learn throughout the book and the blog that whenever you say, I know the owner, guaranteed you don't know the owner.
Yeah.
So just don't bother trying to name drop. It doesn't work. If you know the owner, they're going to know you on site when you walk in. The wait staff will know you. So don't bother trying.
Oh, you're the owner's friend.
Exactly. Yeah. It just doesn't work.
If you have to tell them who you are, then obviously it doesn't mean anything to them, right?
And guess what, folks? That works for any restaurant, not just a high-end restaurant. Even at DPDale, you'd have people coming in saying, I know the owner. Give me free stuff.
You guys
are like, no, you don't.
If you know the owner, then you know he's a cheap SOB.
He's not giving anything free
away. And he wouldn't want me to give you anything free.
Yeah, but whereas if, you know, the owner's girlfriend came in, you guys were like, hey, what do you want? Here's your zone.
Yeah, we'll make it up for you. What do you want? Yeah.
Exactly. So, it just totally different world. Really.
And I'm talking about the original owner, by the way.
Yes.
Not the guys that eventually took it over, because they were super awesome. In case they're listening, which they're probably not.
So the other point of contention we had with it, it's again a concept that we don't agree with, we don't wrap our brains around it, and it makes the waiter come off as kind of obnoxious and self-entitled as much as his customers are, is the idea of when it comes to tipping on high-end alcohol. And he would get pretty disgruntled when somebody would order a $200 bottle of wine, and he wouldn't get tip 20% on it.
Right.
But I don't understand where you think you should be tipped more opening a $200 bottle of wine instead of a $40 bottle of wine. I've never understood that. I've never understood how
it's the same amount of labor to pop a cork.
Exactly.
To pour a little bit so that the customer can make sure that it's not corked.
Yes.
You know, you should be giving that same level of service, so I don't see how you're giving them extra service by fetching in a more expensive bottle of wine.
Yeah.
But I guess that kind of leads to the point where I had a huge problem with
his rules.
Come
off, like, disliking this book.
I know. It was okay. I mean, it wasn't, like, master literature or anything. I finished reading Kitchen Confidential, and I'm totally prepared to say that because he quotes or talks about Kitchen Confidential in his book, that Waiter Rant is a lesser son of Greater Sires.
Yes.
That Kitchen Confidential is way better.
You just finished reading that today. I haven't got to it. I'm going to do it this week.
We're going
to
do an episode about that, too. But my huge thing is when he does, like, the rules. If you can't afford to leave a tip, you can't afford to eat out. Okay, leaving the tip is the right thing to do. I understand that. And I always tip. Same thing with Tracy. Unless we received the most horrible service or were totally ignored the entire time. If you're telling me that I can't afford to eat out because I can't tip you 20% on a hamburger and fries, or more, because they're saying 20% is the bare minimum.
That's another thing. You get the impression from the book that if you tip less than 20%, watch out for
like 20% is the
obnoxious
new
behavior.
15.
Yeah. I don't agree with that at all. He doesn't come out and say it, but I got that impression from the book as well.
So here's what I'm saying. If you're saying to stay at home and not eat at your restaurant, then you can join us on the unemployment line when your restaurant closes because nobody can afford to go and eat because you've totally alienated your crowd and your customers. I'm not saying that you should smooch the customer's butt, but I am saying that if you're going to sit there and detract people from coming to your restaurant when they can afford to pay the bill, you're not going to be in a job for very long. Because eventually the place is going to go under.
And you had stated that in the other times we had recorded, and I agreed with you, and then I read the rest of the blog. Now, the rest of the world looks at the way we tip in North America with confusion and amusement. Most of the rest of the world, they pay their waiters a standard wage. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the United States, and I don't know 100% for Canada, but I believe it's mostly the same in Canada, waiters and waitresses make a lesser wage, and it's expected that the difference is made up in tips to get them at least to minimum wage.
Right.
And they're also taxed on that. They're taxed on a certain percentage of their tips.
Right.
So one would think, well, the easy way to fix this problem if waiters are disgruntled with their tips or being stiffed all the time by customers who don't think they need a tip, is to just say, okay, everybody makes a minimum wage from now on, a better wage. Now, I thought, again, I always thought that was a good solution. I like how other countries do it. You only leave a tip if it was just absolutely outstanding, and even then the tip is no more than 5 or 10%.
Right. Like, even in Japan, that's like a weird... You should just do your job and be happy, and I'm not saying whether this is right or wrong, but in their cultural view, you do your job, you do it the best way you can, and a tip is, like, weird. I don't know.
Well, some places, they'll chase after you thinking you've left money behind on accident. I never tipped in China. I knew ahead of time not to. If I tried to, they would have returned it.
Yeah.
So we had other stories from other people there who had said, I tried to tip once on accident, and they tried to return it to me.
Again, they feel, I'm doing my job. You don't owe me anything else.
Yes.
Thank you for your patronage.
So, and Europe's pretty much the same way as well. There was a blog article that he did about how he doesn't want to see it abolished because waiters will make less money. So rather than offering a decent solution to the problem, he just wants to complain about not making enough money.
Yeah.
My answer is, well, he has since moved away from waiting tables and he's back in his original industry, and that is my answer to his problem. Go back to the original industry that you went to college for, because...
If you don't like it, then don't be a waiter.
Exactly. Now...
Well, because they want the big money tables.
Yeah.
And he does talk about this in the book, that it takes... And I knew this before anyways. It takes a certain kind of person to work in the food industry. And the food industry is kind of... You've got your normal folks, and then it's kind of also a catch-all for the eccentrics, the outsiders, you know, ich bin ein Ausländer, like, crazy, you know? I had a point.
That's okay. I can jump into another point. It goes into one of... You got it? You could do it! Come on, Sheila! Think! Think! Put the hamster back on the wheel!
Hamster's back on the wheel. Okay, so he talks about how waiters are like gamblers. They're looking for, like, the big score.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, it doesn't matter how many times they get stiffed, they're always chasing that big tip, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That big party of seven where everybody throws 20 on the table and it's just ridiculous and they buy him drinks and, you know, you get that, like, once in a while. And then the rest of the time, it's like feast or famine, right?
But they have a pug mentality.
Yes.
Pugs as dogs, if you do something nice for them once, they live in eternal anticipation of it happening again. If you feed them from the table once, a pug's memory is
ironclad, firmly
implanted now I will get more food from this person. And waiters have the same mentality, that I will get another big tip. I've got another big table coming that's going to do that again.
Yeah.
And a gambler's the same way. They focus on their next big win. They don't think of all the losses.
Mm-hmm.
And a pug's thinking of the next giant T-bone that's going to fall off the table, not all the times they've sat there and nobody's dropped anything for them.
That only happened once, and that's because Grandma had a seizure.
But
it might happen
care.
Again! Grandma doesn't live with us anymore.
But you could have happen. One. It might be genetic, you know? So, I have three major points with the book for me. One, I enjoyed and I liked the way he talked about it. It makes a lot of sense. And two, kind of bones of contention. One that I liked was he explained that sometimes women are looked at as poor tippers. And why are they? And he puts forth the perfect point. It's so Occam's razor, it hurts. And that is that when you're little, when you're young, and you're a teenager, when you go out to eat, dad tips. You don't worry about it. Dad's usually paying. When you go out not with dad, half the time when you're a woman, you're going out on a date. And let's be fair, as liberated as most women say they are, the date usually picks up the tab. Unless there's two women paying, two women dating, then you know.
Then you get to fight over it.
Yeah, you get to work out your own little special system. But that makes perfect sense. So you're brought up, dad doesn't sit down and say this is how you tip to a lot of women, so they don't understand that you know, 15% for good service, 20% if you really liked the service, and, you know, maybe 10% or talk to the manager if it's less than, if it was worse.
Right.
My dad sat down and told me, you know, this is what you do, this is how you behave when you go to a restaurant. But mm-hmm. then again, my dad also made sure that I knew how to change the oil by myself and how to change a tire by myself and do all of that, too.
Yeah.
A lot of fathers don't do that with their daughters. So I understand where that stereotype comes from, and I'd like to say, ladies, let's start breaking that stereotype and being decent tippers if the service merits it. And if the service doesn't merit it, don't just stiff them on the tip. Go talk to the manager so they don't just think you're cheap.
They understand you're dissatisfied.
Yes.
Exactly. You should always talk to the manager if there's something wrong, or just talk to them and send it back if there's something wrong with your meal.
And you can flat out, if you're worried about looking like you're trying to fish for free food, say flat out, I don't want anything comped for this. I want you to know I didn't tip that person because they sucked. And you need to do something about them because their poor service ruins your good food.
Exactly.
And it's a very unfair thing for a waiter. A waiter's a lot like a goalie in hockey or soccer. A bad waiter can ruin a good meal, but a good waiter can't do anything to save bad food.
That's true.
And a bad goalie will wreck the best scoring team in the world. And a good goalie still can't do anything to save a bad team, because even if the goalie doesn't let anything through, only lets one through, if his guys aren't scoring, nothing's going to happen. It's
that's
the
true.
Same exact thing. And it's very unfair, but that's the life you pick when you go into waiting and food service.
Right. So my parents, teach your daughters how to pump gas and how to tip.
Exactly.
Well, most women tip their hairdressers.
Yes.
So I don't know why it doesn't extend. They don't think about it, I guess.
I don't know. Well, you also don't tip your hairdresser as much as you usually tip at a restaurant, I think. You tip between 10 and 20 for a hairdresser, depending. It depends.
Yeah.
I do know that he has a book coming out about tipping, where he goes into all these other industries and does research and talks to people about the tipping they receive, from exotic dancers all the way down to hairdressers to masseuses. And as much as I disliked this book, I would like to get the next one, just to kind of see that side of the industry as well, and see what he has to say. So my second major, or rather my first major point of contention with the book, my second point that I felt was a good takeaway from the book, was the whole point about I am entitled to 20%, and if you don't leave it behind, you're obviously just a cheap bastard.
Mm-hmm.
And
20%'s the new 15.
And this may be the newest, maybe the biggest problem I had with the book, and it took me forever to come up with why I had a problem with it.
To isolate.
And to understand that, you have to understand a little bit of my background. I've spent the last 5 years, pretty much, in customer service in a call center. Of those 5 years, 4 years and however many months, I spent as a supervisor. So I would sit down with people and tell them how to be a better agent. And I would run into a certain percentage of people that they would not believe you when you told them they had done a bad job in a call. You would sit down with them and explain what they did wrong, and they refused to believe it. They said, no, there's no way I did that. You're mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have to literally sit down and have them listen to the call and watch their face as they realized that they were an utter and complete jerk to somebody who didn't deserve it on the phone.
Yeah. And didn't you say you still had a couple people that still said...
Let's say of all the people I've coached, I'm going to pull a random number out of the air that I think fits closely. 25% of the people have that mentality. They refuse to believe they could do any wrong. Of those 25%, you take them as a whole, 90% of them will believe you once they hear how badly they did, and they'll be in shock. And they'll sit there, and their face will change. They'll be ashamed and just stunned, and, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. I sound so rude. I sound so snotty.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll immediately correct the behavior and saying, great, that's all it took. You listened to one bad call. You understood, you know, why that person was very angry with you.
Right. Especially on the phone, too, because you don't have
any facial
features to read.
10% of those people, even when they listen to the call and they don't understand why the other person was reduced to tears, they still think they didn't do anything wrong. Those were people who we tried to help out of the industry as quickly as possible. Now, reading this book and hearing all the complaints about people who stiffed the waiter or stiffed his friends, I kind of wonder how many of those fit into that 25%. And when it comes to waiting, you don't get the instant replay kind of feedback that you can give in other industries that have recording equipment. So the only feedback a waiter truly gets is if somebody goes to the manager or you don't tip.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that second type of feedback can be confused with you just being a cheap bastard.
Right.
Which is where that 25% who think they could do no wrong, and obviously their service was excellent, they refuse to believe that they didn't get a tip because they did something wrong. It's always because you're a cheap bastard. And I think the waiter is one of those 25%. After reading the book, seeing how he treats people, and this feeds into my third point of contention, with the book, he's a jerk. And he tries to clean it up in the book, because authors always try to make themselves sound less horrendous than they are. And he even admits at the end that he was a rude jerk at the end to a lot of his coworkers. It was just amazing, and it comes out even more in the blog.
Right.
And he's at heart, he's a good person. He does very nice things. But then when he thinks he's in the right and he can do it, he's a
he has no problem at all.
Jerk.
Being rude to somebody.
Yes, and I think he fits into that. There was one that illustrated it better that was in the blog, and it wasn't in the book. A couple came in, and they were kind of nervous and on edge, and he was talking with them at the restaurant, and they were going to talk to their accountant, because they had to go file their taxes. And they were the woman was just all up in knots, and, oh, we're going to owe a lot of money, we're going to owe a lot of money, I know it, I know we didn't owe last year, but we're just going to get hit so hard this year, I'm so worried. And they asked him if he had filed, and this was the year they did the stimulus checks.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, I've already filed. And they said, oh, did you get anything back? He said, well, let me just put it this way, I'm definitely getting my stimulus check when they send those out in a few months. And they said, oh, you're so lucky, we're so worried, da-da-da-da-da. So when they left, he kind of felt bad for them until he saw the tip, and they had left at like 12.5%. And he was just outraged and furious, and how dare they, you know, they're so worried about their income taxes, maybe they shouldn't be eating out in the first place, blah, 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 blah. Well, one, that may be their last big, splurge for a few months while they have to write their finances. And two, he probably didn't think that he came off kind of snotty, but you kind of almost gloated in front of
them. You rubbed it right in their face.
That you are getting money back that they probably won't see.
So it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
To me,
which someone might come in and you may misread their body language and think that, or you're making broad generalizations, and you think that they're not going to tip, so you give them subpar service, so they don't tip, because you totally deserve what you got, because you were a jerk to them in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that there aren't jerks out there that aren't going to tip you,
mm-hmm.
and there's not cheap people out there that would rather spend all their money on their alcohol and not tip you at all.
Mm-hmm.
But let's be realistic here. I am a Jeffersonian. I don't believe that people at heart are nasty, brutish, and our existences are short. I think that people are generally good, and I don't think that there are so many people out there, even in New York City, which, again, that makes it kind of an extenuating circumstance that this entire book takes place in New York, because that city lives by its own rules. It's got its own culture. I just don't believe that there's that many mean, cheap, and deliberately horrible people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm a little bit idealistic. Maybe it's my Canadian showing, but...
You see, I subscribe to the John Adams School of Thought, where everybody deep down inside is just dirt evil, and we need rules to keep us in check. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as the better side of human nature. So to me, I'm surprised he didn't run into more jerks, and I'm surprised people weren't meaner to him. No, I'm kidding. I'm really not that jaded. But I don't know. I didn't feel very favorably about him in the book when I first read it. Then I read a little bit of the blog.
He wasn't really a sympathetic character.
No, he wasn't sympathetic at all. Then I read the blog, a little bit of it, and I said, maybe he's not too bad. Then I read more of the blog and thought, my God, he's more of a flaming jerk than I thought.
He made that one dude in the book look like a total jerk.
Which
I don't like the word of this podcast is jerk.
It's because we want to use stronger language and we
but
can't.
We want to keep it clean.
Yes.
So that anybody can listen to it. He made the one guy, was it Lane?
Was it the one waiter? The gay waiter?
Yeah. He made him look like a total
jerk. Yeah, in the blog he speaks
jerk.
Very favorably of him.
Yeah.
In the book he makes him sound power-hungry and just petty.
Jerk.
Yeah. The drinking game for this episode is the word jerk. Every time we say jerk, please don't take a shot, just take a drink, because you'll die by the end.
He made him look like a real jerk, but mm-hmm. then when you read the blog, he was buddies with him.
See, I was expecting the book to be something more along the lines of like a Irma Bombeck book, where there are humorous anecdotes from the world of waiting on tables. I wasn't expecting it to be a philosophical treatise on how much the world
of human
sucks.
Nature?
Yes. It was too New York City for me.
Yeah. Oh, that's the other thing that we wanted to talk about. The other thing we wanted to talk about, speaking of New York City, is... Oh, he mentions this movie, Smoke, which is set in a New York City cigar tobacco shop. And again, he references it as a comedy.
It's not a comedy. I know it
Netflix,
says it on IMDb. It says
IMDb
it's a comedy.
IMDb referenced this as a comedy. People, it is not a comedy.
It's depressing.
It is depressing and artistic and New York City. It's not a very good movie to begin with. I was expecting it to be like Barbershop, but with cigars.
I think had we been prepared ahead of time as to how it really was set out, what the movie really was, we would have enjoyed it more, but we were expecting
it
something funny.
It is not a comedy.
It's very depressing. Maybe that's what comedy is in New York. I don't know.
Maybe, like Woody Allen.
We're not Woody Allen fans. Please Sorry, send Woody all Allen. Hate mail to spyfatchicks@gmail.com.
But even the poster for Smoke says, "Where's there smoke, there's laughter," is the tagline for the movie. Mm. There is no laughter in that movie. It's just comes packaged with a razor blade.
You know, to facilitate easy suicide after you watch it, because of the depression it induces. But he is a cigar fan. He does reference that frequently in the blog. I will give him a little bit of credit for that, because we do enjoy a fine cigar once in a while as well. Overall, I don't know if I'd recommend the book unless you can borrow it or pick it up on sale, depending...
Or you're from New York City, in which case you'll probably love it.
Or if you're really into waiting tables, you're a lifelong food service, food industry person, and you believe that you can do no wrong and you're 25%, no, then you'll love it. The blog has its good and bad points. It's a blog. It's really off the cuff, you can tell. Just like we have episodes where I'm sure we really piss people off.
Yeah.
The blog has those moments, too. Like the one where he put the 50 things that you're I can't remember the words he used. It's like a pain in the neck customer.
Oh, 50 signs that you're a bad customer.
Yeah, one was if you ask for diet tonic.
Like, okay.
Yes, it's indeed, Mr. Diplanica. Tonic does have calories. It is made with sugar. Now it's made with high fructose corn syrup. Somebody who's diabetic and might be treating themselves to an alcoholic drink may not want those that extra sugar into their diet. Somebody who does not enjoy high fructose corn syrup because it gives them crippling gas, crippling abdominal cramps, and sometimes induces puking may also not want that in their drink. So it would be wise of you to not just put it in and tell them it's diet anyway, because then when they're sick later on, they may think it was the food and not just you being a self-righteous jerk. It was stuff like that.
He's very
just
judgmental.
Really, really peddled.
I know that
stuff.
We're being judgmental because we're calling him on it, but...
Well, I know part of it was just a therapeutic rant for him, but some of it you had to sit back and say, no, really, were you just pulling stuff out of thin air to make it to 50 for the list so you could have a nice round number, or do you really feel this way? I would sit down and have a beer with the guy, but I would take everything he said with a grain of salt, too.
Yeah.
So... And it's so odd to me that he's so celebrated. I mean, he was all over the media when this came out with his blog.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone
has
hailed
him as... big bloggers that, you know, the new writers, basically, that were discovered. Instead of sending their stuff to publishing houses, they were discovered on the internet.
Yeah. But what the good part of this is, between him referencing it and... the awesome, awesome book of A Year of Eating Dangerously, we're definitely going to read, or Sheila has read Kitchen Confidential. I'm finally going to sit down and read it. It's been out forever, but we're going to do a review on it, just because I feel like we should.
There's a lot of other works that reference it.
Yeah, it's an originating point we need to make ourselves familiar with, and I'm sure some of you might enjoy hearing us talk about it as well. But
especially if you work in the kitchen.
I have nothing else to add about the abomination of Waiter Rant, do you?
Like, when we first started recording this, we're like, it was okay. There was a couple points Tracy didn't like.
And
the more we talked
up.
About it, the more times we tried to record this episode, the more we didn't like it.
It has its good points. There are some parts in the book that were very touchy, like when he helped the couple on Valentine's Day.
Yes. That was noble of him.
That was, I think, one of his high points. There was a couple that came in on Valentine's Day, and you could tell that they didn't go out to a nice restaurant very often, and they were shocked by the prices. And he kind of helped them navigate so they didn't get completely hosed on the bill. Mm. And he was really nice about it. And that's when he showed his human side, where I said, maybe he's not that bad of a guy.
Yeah.
And then he turned around and pulled some other self-righteous jerk move. Like, you know, I know you're going to take a lot of crap from customers throughout your day, but you're never justified in giving it back to them. Because that's the nature of your job, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And this is speaking from somebody with a lot of experience in similar fields. You just sometimes have to sit down and keep taking bites of the poop sandwich and just be satisfied in the fact that someday you will be able to hand somebody else a poop sandwich in a totally different situation. Anything else to add?
Just,
this is our most, like...
Negative episode
ever. But
well,
it's just... I don't know.
We can only look at it from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we can only look at it with our own experiences as the lens. And neither one of us have lived in New York City.
Yeah.
Neither one of us wants to live in New York City. It's a city that lives by its own rules. I have a lot of respect for New York. It's a very beautiful, historic city. But I could never live there.
Yeah.
It takes a special breed of person to live there.
Well, I think you and I both have eliminated one of the common complaints of customers by waiters, by about customers, is that everybody should have to work in the food service industry for 6 months in their life so they understand what it's like, because they assume that most of the people who treat them like crap have never had to do a job like that, and that's probably true. Whereas we disagree with a lot of this, but we've both worked on that side. So we're coming with experience, and we're not just saying, oh, they're less than people, we can treat them like servants. No, we're just saying you've gone over the edge.
Like, a lot of his customers were like old money, and they were used to having things their way.
Yeah.
And then my second point is, this is a cuisine that, again, has its own culture that we're looking at almost like outsiders looking at, or like anthropologists or something, because we've never been part of that sect of society, and we have no intentions of joining it.
We would be the couple that goes in for Valentine's Day that would need help from the waiter. No, we would be aware of what we were getting into, but nonetheless, we would be that type of customer. We only go there once a year, if that.
Yeah.
Special occasion thing. We'd be more likely to go to a sushi place than that kind of place anyway, though. I was entertained by the woman who called in to ask if they had sushi, and he said, no, we're an Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
Well, do you have tuna? Yes. Well, can you make sushi with it? No, no, we can't.
No, not like that. I just pictured, like, a big chunk of seared tuna on a piece of risotto. Like a blob of risotto.
Italian sushi. That'd be awesome.
Anyway.
You could totally put that on a menu somewhere, too.
Someone would probably pay for it.
A rare tuna steak on risotto. Italian sushi. So this is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Zwei Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening. This episode that finally got recorded.
We hope you enjoyed this Zwei Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on MySpace and or Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends, but please make sure that credit is given. Once again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you have a great day.